Receive one, and then later on you decide to drop the course, or ask to request that everyone return them, and return it to Rajab Abhihari Das and myself. The grading system will be as follows. The attendance, this is more or less, it's not, you don't get an extra scholarship or a degree if you get a high mark. But this is just to give you a rough, those who are interested in the grades, just to give you a rough idea of how I'll decide what the grade is. We don't, sometimes Rabindranath Tagore once told me that the way he used to grade tests, or some professors grade tests in college, so they take the test and they throw them down the stairs. It's going to which level they land. But we try and do it a little bit more organized than that. So the attendance in class is 20%. And we request everyone to come on time. The class participation is another 20%. And the midterm and the final together is 60%. But I don't think you have to worry about it. The tests are rather easy. I mean, I don't want to say that they're too easy. But there are multiple choice tests, or maybe I'll put on some true and false tests. The reason for that is that way you won't have to be in anxiety, and neither do I have to be in anxiety marking the test. It makes it a lot easier. Generally, the final will count more than the midterm, depending what you do better on. Why to take the course? There may be many reasons why someone would take the course. I just wrote down a few of them. One of them is to understand what level I personally may be on. That is, each one of us individually, what level of advancement we may be on. The reason for that may be many. One is that Rupa Goswami has advised us to understand clearly what level of advancement we're on. That way, of course, we'll know if we're going to the next level or if we're not going to the next level. He also advises the nectar of instruction. He also advises the nectar of instruction that we shouldn't imitate the behavior of a higher devotee. Because the tendency is, especially Prabhupada explains, not to imitate the behavior of a Mahabhagavata devotee. Because by doing so, one will eventually become degraded. So everyone should understand very clearly what level we're on. It's a question, not a question of humility, that, you know, actually I'm a fallen devotee. Many times devotees used to tell Prabhupada things like, Prabhupada, well, I'm the most fallen. Prabhupada used to say things like, well, you're not the most anything. Or Prabhupada, I'm so fallen. So Prabhupada would say, well, do something about it then. Therefore, we should understand what level we're on so that we can actually do something about it to make some advancement higher. Now the question may be, if the Mahabhagavata is the most humble devotee, he sees everyone as a greater devotee than he does, then doesn't he think that, how does he understand what level he's on? Is that there?
No, it's
sticking
with the
drawers
and it's not on the desk.
Oh yeah, it needs to be
somewhere. Maybe it's in your, one of the little wraith thing.
Yes. Sorry. Okay.
That if one is a Mahabhagavata devotee, then how does he understand that he's actually Mahabhagavata devoted? Because he's actually the most humble. So therefore he'll think that he's on the lowest level. But I don't think most of us have that problem. We don't have to worry about whether we're Mahabhagavatas or not. But at least we should try to understand what the Madhyama Adhikari devotee is in the different stages of Madhyam. And that way, be able to see what is our position, how we're supposed to act in order to come to the next higher level, or next higher levels. We'll find that Bhakti Yoga is not that you get, as soon as you graduate from Kanista Adhikar, immediately there's a graduation ceremony, and you advance towards Madhyam. But that the state is very gradual, and sometimes we may act like a Kanista Adhikar, even though we may be on the Madhyama Adhikar platform in general. And sometimes we may act like a Madhyama Adhikari, although we may be a Kanista Adhikari in general. So these things will help us ascertain what is our proper behavior according to our status. The other thing is that we should know how much to instruct others. At the Nectar of Instruction, Srila Prabhupada explains that before one becomes a spiritual master, he should know, he should be on the Uttama Adhikari platform. So everyone is actually, in our movement, has to act as a spiritual master in some capacity or another. Of course, Prabhupada was referring mostly to diksha, giving diksha to disciples. But still, everyone should know how much we should instruct others according to our level of advancement. That so Prabhupada also mentions that a neophyte and intermediate devotee, they may also accept disciples, but they should understand that due to their insufficient guidance, such disciples can't advance very easily in devotional service. So although every one of us is expected to give instruction, when we understand clearly what level we're on, then we'll also, part of our instruction, or at least part of it, will be referring others to encouraging people to take guidance also from others. Sometimes we may think that I may meet someone on the street and give them a book, but also I should also encourage others to take guidance, to join, come to our movement and take guidance from others whom I actually see are on a higher platform. So the second thing is that we should also be able to understand who's on what level of advancement. So we'll be able to recommend people to take guidance from them. If I don't understand who's on a higher level of advancement than I am, or if I think that no one's on a higher level of advancement than I am, then of course I won't encourage anyone to take instruction from anyone except for myself. And that way the Krishna consciousness movement will probably be somewhat limited. And also we should understand, because we're always looking for either to give guidance to others or to take guidance from others. So when we understand the different levels of advancement, we're able to ascertain who's on what level to some degree. Then we'll also be able to give guidance to others appropriately and also take the guidance from others appropriately. And of course, if one is looking for a Diksha Guru, then that's essential that one understands who's on what level before one takes initiation. Not that I take initiation, I suddenly decide that actually I have a Kanista Adhikari Guru. I should have bought a better one. Well, that's not very good. One should have some faith by knowledge, not simply sentiment. So this is, also I find that, at least one of the ways it's helped me personally, is that Maya is always trying to dissuade us from the goal. Maya is always trying to encourage us that there's some other goal other than Krishna, other than to become absorbed in Krishna consciousness. But when we understand, when we hear about the different levels of advancement, then there's like some hope that actually Krishna is not only the goal, but it's possible gradually, even in this lifetime, to actually become Krishna conscious. And so although Maya will always tell us that there's some other more pressing thing than to become Krishna conscious at the moment, gives us some more conviction that I have to give up these ideas that are drawing me away from Krishna, this mood that's drawing me away from Krishna, and try and attach myself to the lotus feet of Krishna. So, let me take attendance now. Are there any questions about this? Anyone have any questions in general about the course? Or the three main books that we're going to cover are the Madhurya Kandambini by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the Neck of Instruction, and the Harinam Chintamani, certain sections from there.
The Madhurya Instruction,
no, we'll give out the Neck of Instruction. That's the next thing I'll do. How many devotees have the... Well, let me say, how many devotees don't have the Neck of Instruction? Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So we'll bring them, hopefully tomorrow, hopefully they have it. So I suggest that everyone begins reading if you have the outline here. Now, if you look at the outline, the first day is the introduction, so it's a short class. The second day is definition of Uttama Bhakti and Madhurya Kandambini, the difference between Bhakti, Karma, Jnana, and Yoga. I have to apologize for the blanks in the outline. This is Vrindavan. So I suggest that it's always good to keep ahead of the reading. There's actually not, some days there's not very much reading, but in other days there's more. So if you keep ahead, a little ahead of the reading, it's actually, it'll help you. So that way, when you come to a day which has three or four reading assignments, which aren't that long, you won't think that, you know, why did he give me 2 hours of reading today? Because on the other days, it'd probably only be 15 or 20 minutes or an hour of reading. But certain days, there's a little bit more. So I suggest that you start reading the Madhurya Kandambini and read at least the first chapter, although it'll take 2 days to cover it. And then after that, just keep a little ahead, especially when you get the Nectar of Instruction. If you read one or two verses ahead, that would be good. And if you have any questions, yes?
I'm just wondering, how does the idea of humility, which is recommended and displayed by great devotees, how does it fit in with the idea that we may be able to understand or have a reasonable idea what level we're on, and it may not possibly be such a low level like a Kanishta, and maybe we're on a Madhyamakari level, technically. Then, what would be, you know, if we read Krishna's Kaviraj in CC, he's expressing the idea that he's on a very low level, to say the least. Would he at other times understand that he's actually on a Madhyamakari? You know, how would it fit in as one is actually advancing, but then one is meant to be, or one may be feeling that one is on a very low level?
One time, just a paraphrase. Did everyone hear the question? Just a paraphrase what Prabhupada once said. He once pointed, someone once wrote a letter to him saying that I demand to see Krishna. And Prabhupada said, how can I demand to see Krishna? That if I examine my qualifications to see Krishna, I'll find out that I have no qualifications. All I have is disqualifications, but my spiritual master is dragging me home. In other words, that a devotee who makes advancement, he doesn't think that he's making advancement by himself. He realizes more and more his dependency both on the spiritual master, the other Vaishnavas, and Krishna. So although he may make advancement, he doesn't take the credit for his personal advancement. He gives the credit to his spiritual master and Krishna and the association of the devotees. But the more one advances, the more the whole philosophy becomes clear, including one's own position. On the highest platform, on the higher platforms, it's not that he thinks, well, I'm so humble, therefore I'm so advanced, but he understands more or less how much Krishna has actually revealed himself. to the devotee how much he's actually free from material attachment. As Prabhupada said, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nisho Shiti Nakam Shiti. He becomes completely joyful. And the other thing it's pointed out is that just like when you eat a meal, that simultaneously with each bite, you feel satisfaction, alleviation of hunger, as well as growing strength. So with the progression of bhakti, you feel detached from everything that doesn't bring one or give one Krishna conscious, growing detachment from that, a growing awareness of Krishna, and growing attraction for Krishna. So one can feel it just like one eats a meal. As far as humility, as I just pointed out, or tried to point out, is that the devotee doesn't take credit for his advancement. He knows that the more he becomes dependent on Krishna, the more he becomes detached from material false ego. Material ego means that I'm thinking myself independent and I'm thinking myself the doer of my activities. But Krishna consciousness means that I'm actually not doing anything. Actually, Krishna is the doer. And that I'm not independent in any way from Krishna. Therefore, one becomes Krishna conscious. He thinks, he sees, here's Krishna. He's unlimitedly beautiful. He knows everything. He's all-powerful. He's controlling everything here. So it's very difficult for a devotee to be very puffed up. He thinks, well, here I am. I'm 1/10,000th the size of tip of hair in size. I can't even become 2/10,000ths. And Krishna is unlimited. But, you know, so therefore he automatically feels rather humble.
So when, say, Krishna is Kaviraj Goswami, just in the case of that, he might be aware, according to these standards that actually are on the Uttamadhikari platform, but he'd still think that his son actually is very fallen at the same time.
Yeah. When he's writing Chaitanya Charitamrita, that is one of the qualifications for being an Uttamadhikari, is to feel like that.
But would he be conscious that actually I'm an Uttamadhikari?
I don't think, you mean if you asked him what level, yes, an Uttamadhikari, he's the only one who can see everyone else clearly, what level they're on. Therefore, he is conscious of his position.
And he still feels himself to be very...
That's one of the qualities. In other words, he can... Because of Krishna's unlimited potencies, he has inconceivable contradictory potencies which reconciliate themselves. So simply the pure devotee is given the facility to either feel unlimitedly humble and fallen, and at the same time Krishna gives him the discrimination of this, to understand things clearly. It's inconceivable. That's akin to Shakti. Even at the end of Madhuri Kandamini, we find suddenly Krishna appears before the devotee. The devotee is completely overwhelmed in an ocean of ecstasy where all his senses, sometimes Krishna is revealing different aspects of himself and the devotee is fainting out of ecstasy. And then finally Krishna reveals, you know, the abode of Vrindavan and Srimati Radharani and all the Palamanas and everyone. He becomes overwhelmed with waves of ecstasy and falls unconscious. And he wakes up and he thinks, you know, maybe it was just some good fortune or to this fallen soul, maybe some drop of mercy was given to me by some great Vaishnava. So he realizes, or maybe it was just a dream, but it wasn't a dream because all my senses are all pure. I don't feel like I'm not coming out of unconsciousness. But ultimately, when you see his mentality is very humble. He's always thinking, it's by the grace of my guru, he's bringing me to this position. So he knows he's at the position. Just like in the... what's the name of the book? Brihad Bhagavatamrita. There was one devotee named Swarup. And he finally, he's in Vrindavan, in Goloka Vrindavan, and Krishna is coming towards him. And he's thinking that, and he embraces Swarup, and they both fall on the ground in ecstasy, and Swarup is thinking that, you know, Krishna is embracing this humble self. But he knows, here's Krishna, I'm finally in Goloka Vrindavan. But he's not thinking, here I am, Krishna, finally. He's thinking, I'm just a humble devotee of Krishna. And his mentality throughout is he had one spiritual master who he met on the Jamuna. And he was always thinking, how am I, you know, by the grace of my spiritual master and the mantra he's given to me, gradually I'm able to advance from one platform to the next. Anything else? Let me take attendance now. So, besides that, if you have any questions, please write them down on a piece of paper, because that way you won't forget. And I won't forget what the question is either. And then if you can give it to me at the beginning of class, or even a topic, and that way we can discuss these things during class. And sometimes we may be a little shy, thinking that why should I ask a question? But many times we may have some question, but others have the same question, but they're also a little shy to ask it. Therefore, if one of us gets brave enough, then we can ask the question.
Swayam rupa kadamayam didati svapadantikam vandayam shigaro shiyudhavara kamala.
The Madhurikandambini. We'll get more Madhurikandambinis. And also we'll be getting Harinam Chintamanis. That should be coming from... Does everyone have one? Do you miss one? We'll be getting some Harinam Chintamanis that should be coming from Bombay soon. So how many devotees will be attending the class that don't have a Madhurikandambini? Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Everyone else says, okay, 5. Also, here's some more outlines. Could you pass these out? Whoever doesn't have an outline, we can get some more of them, but these are some of the outlines. Raise your hand if you don't have an outline, he'll give you one. Anyone else? We'll start with this definition of Uttama Bhakti. This is a very famous verse from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Anya Vilasita Shunya Jnana Kamina Abhitam Anukulena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhakti Uttama. So this can be broken up into two different parts. The first part defines what is Uttama Bhakti. Anukulena Krishna Nushilanam Bhakti Uttama. And the second part, Anya Vilashita Shunyam Jnana Karmida Avritam. This explains the unique character, super excellent characteristic of bhakti. These are commentated by in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. This verse is those commentaries by Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura as well as other acharyas. So we'll try and go into a little bit about the commentaries, but they're quite intricate, so I don't think we can cover it to the full extent that would do justice to the commentaries. But there's in the second part here, which is actually really the first part, it's defining what is bhakti. And here we find that the word anukulyena, Krishna, and shilana define uttama bhakti. Uttama bhakti means the actual bhakti that we're looking for, real bhakti, real love for Krishna. So this word, anukulyena, means that, or we'll start with, it's actually anushilanam. Anushilanam means activities, it's a verb. Activities what? Activities in relationship to Krishna. So bhakti has to have something in relationship to Krishna. Now, anush, because it's a verb, it means by body, by mind, and with words. So it has to have something to do with relationship to Krishna, either positive or negative. Positive means to follow the rules and regulations, such as chanting 16 rounds, attending Mangal Arati, seeing the deities in the temple. And the negative aspect means to avoid the offenses, not to let the mind wander, etc. So, shilanam means works or activities in relationship to Krishna, and this word anu means one after another. That means that devotion to Krishna should be constant, it should be continuous. And this other word, anukulyena, that which is favorable towards Krishna. That it's not enough just to do something in relationship to Krishna, but it also should be anukulyena, that which is giving delight to Krishna. The Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and others, they comment that giving delight to Krishna is not sufficient. Therefore, it has to be both shilanam in relationship to Krishna and anukulyena, giving delight to Krishna. But this anukulyena, they say that if we define just that which gives delight to Krishna, that's not sufficient. Because that would imply, for instance, that there are 18 demons, including demons such as Dantravakra, who fought with Krishna with an inimical attitude. And yet Krishna was immensely pleased by their activities. But their activities can't be defined as bhakti. On the other hand, if we take activities such as Mother Jasoda, or at least this is a commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, but there's some controversy about that. In any case, the first thing we have to understand is that it has to be anukulyena, giving delight to Krishna, and it has to be anushilanam, those activities which are reflect a non-hostility on the part of the devotee. That is, with the proper mentality or service attitude of the devotee, and giving delight to Krishna. And the second, any questions about that? Therefore, anything that's giving delight to Krishna, that's not with a favorable attitude of the devotee, that can't be considered bhakti. On the other hand, it may be with a favorable attitude of the devotee, but if it doesn't give delight to Krishna, then it's also not considered to be bhakti. And the second part, or the first part over here, is anya vilashita shunya. That means, without any desire, then the desire to simply please Krishna. That all the desires are focused simply with the desire that Krishna will be pleased. And the second part of it is jnana, karma, adi, and anavritam. Avritam means covered, and anavritam means uncovered by jnana, karma, and yoga, or by other things such as vairagya or renunciation. This is mentioned because jnana, there is karma, such as worship of the service of the deities in the temple. There is jnana, cultivating knowledge about Krishna. But such knowledge and jnana and karma, such activities, cannot cover bhakti. That there are activities, there is cultivation of knowledge, but such activities and knowledge do not cloud the inherent nature of bhakti. So with this in mind, this is the definition of Uttama Bhakti. Yes.
So Dear Ashwamaraj was speaking a bit about this yesterday and gave the example of Mother Yashoda who puts baby Krishna down because the milk is boiling. So Krishna becomes his priest. But her attitude is to please Krishna because the milk is also a devotee of Krishna like that. So I understood that is bhakti, but now you're saying that.
Well, we have to be careful about it. First of all, this is an example that Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur will just explain it more so that everyone understands what the point is. See, when they're defining anukul yena, it has to be favorable, pleasing to Krishna. The example is used by Srila in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu by one of the commentators that when Mother Yashoda was breastfeeding Krishna, the milk was boiling from the stove. And this time she put Krishna down and Krishna became very disturbed and started to cry. So apparently this was not very favorable or pleasing to Krishna. But of course we know that the activities in the transcendental realm are all pleasing to the devotee and Krishna. So when we're defining bhakti here, we're defining bhakti for the sadhaka, for those who are in conditioned life. We're not trying to define bhakti for the those who are the nitya paramas of Krishna, lila paramas, because all their sports in the transcendental realm are all pleasing. They're all full of transcendental ecstasy. So Krishna was actually immensely pleased when Mother Yashoda put him down. His crying is just external. It's just a show. Even in the Krishna book, Prabhupada writes, Krishna wiped away his false tears, bit his lip, and then took a stone and broke the pot. But we're defining this is a definition for ourselves, not for Mother Yashoda. Yeah.
Actually, above prema, there are a few other levels going up to Mahabha. One of them is mana, which I just learned that was yesterday. And that means that mock anger in the root of love. So it's actually specifically a manifestation of love and pleasure on his part, not actually
anything else about this? This is so we can understand what is the difference between Uttama Bhakti and Mishra Bhakti. Mishra Bhakti means that which is mixed, or other types of so-called bhakti which are not bhakti, such as the fighting of the demons against Krishna, their achieving liberation, is not considered to be bhakti. Kamsa's attitude towards Krishna is not bhakti, although he was constantly meditating upon Krishna day and night. So here, when first-class devotional service develops, one must be devoid of all material desires, knowledge obtained by monistic philosophy and fruit of action. And the devotee must constantly serve Krishna favorably as Krishna desires. So once again, just to go over it, that the Swarup Lakshana, the Lakshana means characteristic, and Swarup means the constitutional characteristics of bhakti. The most important, the main characteristics is that Krishna, it must be in relationship to Krishna with the favorable attitude of the devotee, and it must give delight to Krishna. And the secondary characteristics that emphasize the unique quality of bhakti is that it's devoid of anything material. It's above anyabhilashita shunyam. It's without any other motivation other than to please Krishna. And jnana karma arvita. Although jnana karma or yoga or any other type of activities may be performed, but they cannot cover the nature of bhakti. So now we'll go over something about the Madhurya Kandambini. The Madhurya Kandambini begins with giving us an explanation of bhakti. So we have to understand what is bhakti, first of all, because our general tendency is to confuse bhakti with material activities, especially in the beginning. That is, if someone is very learned, if someone is very expert at something, sometimes we may think that actually he's progressed in bhakti due to his expertise or his learning. But expertise in the material world, or material knowledge, or even spiritual theoretical knowledge, is not necessarily the symptom that someone is advanced in bhakti. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura, he's trying to give us the understanding so we can differentiate between bhakti and karma, jnana, and yoga. Karma, of course, means those activities which are in relationship to the Vedic literature. That is, pious activities is karma. Activities which are not in not following the injunctions in the Vedas are called bikarma, or unauthorized activities. And what is the definition of gyan? Does anyone know?
Philosophical speculation on the impersonal realm.
Yeah, that's true. Anything else besides that? Excuse me? I mean, ultimately, that's what it is. Gyan is any kind of knowledge. But ultimately, that knowledge in the Vedic literature ultimately leads to liberation. So in the Vedas, generally, we'll find that there's three different parts of the Vedas. One part deals with karma, to regulate one's activities in the material world, to cut down on sense gratification and competition. And then after one becomes frustrated with sense gratification, then he cultivates knowledge of oneself, or jnana, with the ultimate aim of liberation and salvation. And yoga, what is the definition of yoga?
Link with Krishna.
Excuse me?
To link with Krishna.
Yes, that's the ultimate yoga. That is actually yoga. Yoga is also those activities which bring one in connection with the super soul. So here, when he's talking about karma, jnana, yoga, he's talking about in relationship to the super soul. And Patanjali's yoga system is rather confusing, because at first it encourages one to link with the super soul, and that with the idea of achieving bliss, and then he encourages one to merge into the super soul. So in that way, it's not very favorable. I mean, it's all right to be blissful in relation to the super soul, but then when you try to become him, it becomes a little difficult. So here he's saying that bhakti, bhakti has no material cause. And it's completely independent. It's independent of karma, jnana, and yoga. That doesn't mean that if one becomes expert in bhakti, he doesn't necessarily, he automatically acquires karma, jnana, and yoga. Bhakti is the most pious of all the activities. And it doesn't mean that if one becomes expert at karma, jnana, and yoga, he becomes expert in bhakti. It's completely independent of these things, although one who becomes expert in bhakti automatically acquires the others. The way that Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur will explain to us about bhakti's independence is not by use of logic, it's by use of authority. So he begins, Madhuri Kandambini begins with the verse, Savai Pum So Pro Dharmo Yuto Bhakti Ahokshage Ahaitu Kyaprati Ataya Yatma Supersedati. And he's emphasizing that bhakti is has the same nature as Krishna, ahaituki. Hetu means cause, and ahaituki means it has no material cause. Of course, we understand in Srimad Bhagavatam, we also understand that bhakti has to be unmotivated and uninterrupted in order to completely satisfy the self. So to understand what is this bhakti, he begins with explaining, it's independent of karma, jnana, and yoga, and he uses the word yadrichaya. Because then Yadritraya means that which comes of its own accord. So there are two verses in the Bhagavad Gita that I know of that have that word in it. Does anyone know one of them? Yadritcha chopapanam swargam dwaram upadritam sukhina kshatriya parta labhate yujyam idrisham. That happy are the kshatriyas, O Partha, to whom such fighting opportunities come, you could say of their own accord or unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planet. And Yadrichaya chopapanam Yadritcha Shantantushto Vanvatito Vimatsaraha Samaksaras Vausidav Chakrit Vapinanavadite. One who is satisfied with gains which come of their own accord. So bhakti is defined in the some Sanskrit verses, and they contain Yadrichaya. That bhakti comes of its own accord. But sometimes some people say that this Yadricha means by good fortune. But Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, he contradicts that by saying, or he opposes that notion that it could come simply by good fortune, by pious activities, because pious activities within the material realm have their cause is sukrita, or pious actions, which means that bhakti would have to be caused by material pious activities, which it's not. And if we say that the cause of bhakti is inexplicable or undefinable, then there's no, it also becomes meaningless to say that. So he says that this yadricha means of its own accord, causelessly. Because, first of all, bhakti can't become dependent on material pious activities. And that's contradictory to its independent, self-manifesting nature. And if it's not due to pious activities, then I mean, because it's inexplicable, and therefore if it's inexplicable, we can't really talk about it, and it's just discarded. Any questions about this? Yes.
So somebody might say, Maharaj, that, for instance, it's verse Vasudeva Bhakti Bhakti Yoga Priyotita, that by rendering devotee service, one immediately acquires causes knowledge and detachment. So from bhakti comes knowledge and detachment, jnana, for instance. But they might add, but here we see we are cultivating knowledge again, for instance, in the IHA. And in our regular practice of devotional service, we have activities that we perform. And we kind of take it that by cultivating knowledge, Mr. Srila Prabhupada said we have to read the books. We have to cultivate again. And we have to practice our regular devotional service, our practical devotional service. And we see it as linked up with attaining the ultimate goal of bhakti. So then I said that it seems that bhakti is dependent on performing these activities.
Well, when they perform the activities and they receive bhakti, though. Or when they receive bhakti even without performing these activities. So bhakti, there may be some relationship to jnana, karma, and yoga, because we're practicing bhakti yoga, in relationship to bhakti. But the karma that we're performing, or the activities that we're performing, they themselves are bhakti. And the jnana that we're cultivating is itself bhakti. We're cultivating knowledge about bhakti, which is bhakti. And we're doing activities in relationship to bhakti, which is itself bhakti. So actually, this is not the karma, jnana, and yoga that, about bhakti. This is the karma, yoga, and the material sphere that we're talking about here. Because the karma, jnana, and yoga in the spiritual realm is bhakti itself. Or at least we should say it's not different from bhakti.
On the top of page 4, I don't know if you've got that. Charity, austerity,
it's Yeah, we're just starting with this first part. This is going to lead to the understanding how bhakti is self-manifested. Because it's like Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura, he's using the scriptures to prove it. He's already In other words, he's saying that according to definition, bhakti has no material cause. It's just like Krishna. Krishna makes his appearance, although it appears that he comes because Lord Brahma went to the Swetadweep and asked Krishna to come, and Devaki and Vasudev were in danger, so he came to save his devotees. But ultimately, we know that although there are apparently so many causes for Krishna's coming, Krishna doesn't have to come. He can just send, saris, a lot of things to do. But he comes. So the cause of Krishna's coming, it may have some apparent causes. Just like it may be apparent that, Brahma went and asked Krishna to come. There's so many demons on the planet. Vasudeva, Devaki, they were in danger, so Krishna came to save his devotees. But ultimately, his coming is a haituki, it has no cause. So similarly, bhakti's appearance, we have to understand, is also causeless from the point of view. It's not that it has no cause, that you just walk down the street and the good fairy zaps you with bhakti. And she doesn't know why, but you just look like a good person here. It has no cause from the material point of view. In other words, the cause, the reason for bhakti's appearance, that's King Riga. But what was his result? What did he become? Immediately, at least.
Immediately.
A lizard. So he performed so many pious activities, he gave away more cows than there were stars in the sky, and more cows than the grains of sand on the beach. And they weren't ordinary cows. They were first-class cows, and they were giving milk, and he gave away the calves, too. They had golden horns and silver plates on their feet, and they were all decorated with silken wraps. He gave these to first-class qualified Brahmins, and what was his result immediately, at least? He became a lizard. So he didn't achieve bhakti simply by giving away cows, although his result, his punya, for this activity was that even Yamaraj couldn't quite figure out how much pious activity he had accrued. But he had committed one little fault and he went and became a lizard. Fortunately, though, he must have had some contact with the devotees. And therefore, even as a lizard, he was constantly remembering Krishna. So as a king giving away cows, that in itself was not very conducive to bhakti necessarily. But as a lizard remembering Krishna, because then he got the opportunity to see Krishna. So better to become a lizard and perform bhakti than a demigod performing, or a king performing pious activities. So yadrisha is not by pious activities, so then what is it? Then if we say that bhakti is bestowed by Krishna, then we're thinking that then Krishna is showing favor to some and he's not showing favor to others. So that would make Krishna, there's some cause. Then what is the cause? Why does Krishna show favor to some and disfavor, but neglects others? So that is inconclusive in itself and it needs further explanation. So as a fact, Krishna himself, he comes and annihilates the demons and he shows favor to the devotees. So Krishna has some inclination to bestow bhakti to his devotees. So that's not a fault on Krishna's part, it's considered an asset. So what else? So Krishna, so first we say pious activities, that's not the ultimate cause. And if we say Krishna giving bhakti, well that's not the ultimate cause either. There must be some reason why Krishna gives bhakti to some and not to others. So then Krishna, he favors his devotee. And the devotee, he can discriminate. And indeed, it's the job of the Madhyama Bhakta. He has to discriminate. An Uttama Bhakta, on the level of working as an Uttama Bhakta, he sees everyone as a greater devotee than he is. That doesn't mean that he necessarily thinks that, the worm in the stool is performing great devotional service to Krishna. I mean, he has a discrimination to see who's doing what in the material world. But he thinks that everyone else is performing more, everyone else is serving Krishna in his own way except for him. Therefore, he's not very likely to give bhakti, to bestow Krishna's kripa shakti. Kripa means mercy and shakti means potency to anyone else, because he thinks, why should I do that? They already have more bhakti than I do. I should get it from them. But the Madhyama Bhakta, he discriminates between those who are devotees of Krishna, those who are innocent, and those who are opposed to Krishna. So, to those who are devotees of Krishna, he makes friendship with them. To those who are innocent, he bestows Krishna's kripa shakti upon them. So Krishna, he gives the devotee the right to bestow his shakti or kripa shakti or bhakti shakti upon the innocent persons. And so the devotee, the Madhyama Adhikar, especially the preacher, he gives mercy to the innocent. And because he bestows his mercy upon the innocent, then Krishna's shakti or bhakti shakti or kripa shakti follows the shakti of the devotee. That is, if the devotee wants to help someone, then Krishna also gives his mercy. So of course the devotee, he may have a little mercy to bestow, but Krishna, he has unlimited mercy to bestow. So finally we find that the cause is that Krishna has invested the right for the Madhyama Adhikari specifically to bestow his mercy upon the innocent, and the cause is the Madhyama Adhikari. But then again, we have to find out, where did he get the mercy from? So he got the mercy because bhakti is in his heart and it's manifested himself. We can understand it's come from bhakti itself. That the Madhyama, any devotee, he gets mercy because bhakti was bestowed upon him by the mercy of bhakti. So ultimately the cause is bhakti, the bhakti within the devotee's heart. So again, we come back to the same point, that the cause of bhakti is bhakti. It's causeless, from the, at least on the material sphere. The bhakti operates eternally on the spiritual realm and manifests itself in the material world through the devotee and then Krishna's mercy also follows. Is that clear? Yes.
There do seem to be some cases where, at least if the person had contact with the devotee before, it's not mentioned, they seem to get mercy directly from Krishna or, say, Lord Chaitanya or Lord Nityananda. That's one example. There's no mention. I mean, perhaps we can just assume that he must have served the devotees or got the mercy of some devotee or devotees previously. Or Jagannath and Madhai and people like that who are delivered by Lord Chaitanya, as he was saying, traveling around South India. Is there some place for that?
I mean, if the Krishna directly bestowed his mercy.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course there is. Krishna, there's also there's different ways of getting mercy, but generally bhakti manifests itself through the devotee. But Krishna can also, if he desires, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was taking the part of the devotee.
Yeah, that's true.
But we do find that in that case of Krishna reaching his hand into the well, taking out Mriga, and he's turning into a demigod. Or Krishna knocking over the twin Arjuna trees, and they're developing the forms of the demigod. Well, in that case, we find that there was Narada Muni behind the whole thing. And here we find that Krishna reaching into the well to examine it because his sons, were all devotees, asked him to do it.
So it would seem, at least according to these statements, that one might have to rule out the possibility of Krishna ever, even say when he's moving on the planet, just giving his mercy independent of a devotee having given their mercy before to some person who happens to him. Otherwise it sort of clashes
Krishna,
with this.
One thing we didn't mention about this Anukulyena Krishna knew is that when we assume, when we talk about Krishna, we also mean Krishna along with his devotees. They don't really move separately. Whenever we have Krishna, we also have his devotees there. Just like when we talk about the king and he asked for his guard to come. It means he asked the guard to come with his clothing on and weapons. We don't mean that the king, the guard should come in naked without anything else. So similarly, when we talk about Krishna, we also infer or understand that means Krishna along with his devotees. So even when we see Krishna moving on the planet, we never see him alone. He's with his devotees.
Yeah. But if Krishna is giving his mercy, then that's directly without him.
Krishna doesn't give his mercy unless it's authorized by his devotees.
So that would mean then that when Krishna apparently just gives his mercy, there must be having some contact with the devotee beforehand.
It was always that thing. Well, even in the past times we examine it, that Krishna, he's moving along with his devotees. And there's some relationship there. At least we know that Krishna always confers with his devotees before. Just like if we want to approach Krishna, we can't approach Krishna directly to get a favorable result. We have to go through, for instance, the disciple succession. That Krishna, he's owned by Srimati Radharani. And if you want to find out if Srimati Radharani, for her to give her authorization, you have to get an authorization from Lalita, Vishaka, and the other gopis. And then they have their sub-assistant succession. It goes all the way down. So you have to get at least the current representative, that link to them. And if he approves and everyone else approves, he's actually the representative and he approves, then they approve, then you get Krishna's mercy. But to try to approach Krishna indirectly will not be very fruitful. Now, if we find that Krishna, he was along with his cowherd boyfriends in Mathura, and someone came with a garland. Sudama came with a garland Krishna. Krishna offered all kinds of benedictions, you know, to Sudama. We can understand that if we really trace it, that it wasn't by accident that he came and treated Krishna respectfully, giving him a garland, offering him all kinds of worship. There must have been some instruction coming from the devotees.
So, as you're saying, that beyond the cause is Bhakti, so we understand that Srimati Radharani, she is Bhakti Devi. So, beyond the cause of Bhakti is Srimati Radharani, is that a proper understanding?
Well, Bhakti makes its appearance in this material world due to Bhakti. In other words, Bhakti, its cause is from the spiritual world. And even when it appears in the material world, the cause is not something mundane, it's transcendental. As far as Srimati Radharani, we know that, as we said, that everyone has a little Bhakti in them, a little Swarup Shakti. But ours is very small compared to hers. She's the actual manifestation of Krishna's Swarup Shakti, or Chit Shakti. So that without Srimati Radharani's favorable nod, no one will get Bhakti. Because she herself is Bhakti. If she's favorable, then that is Bhakti itself. But here he's not trying to pinpoint Srimati Radharani. He's just trying to explain that if we want to trace back where Bhakti is coming from, it's not coming from the material world, or by material sphere of activities, or by cultivating material knowledge or expertise, or by becoming expert at sense and mind control. It's coming because you're doing something in relationship to Krishna which is pleasing to him and his associates in the transcendental platform, and therefore they're bestowing their bhakti. Yeah.
Another question is, sometimes it's thought that somebody who comes in contact with a devotee, let's say devotees out in Sankirtan, preaching engagement, etc., and somebody comes in contact and they're favorable. So sometimes it's thought that that conditioned soul has come in contact with the devotee, maybe due to previous pious activities, that they're in such a situation to be receptive to Krishna consciousness. That's the first part of my question. If there's any validity in that. And the other is, if somebody is very, very sinful and not so receptive to Krishna consciousness, if the devotee is very intensely desiring to help that person, then can that play a part in that person taking some form of Krishna consciousness? Meaning, can that devotee's intense desire overweigh the person's sinful past for that person becoming a recipient?
There's many things Prabhupada said. We'll start one at a time and try and reach some conclusion. In the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says that those who are sinful, foolish, deceitful, they cannot actually accept the path of bhakti. That's the verse, Yesham Twanta Kadham Bhavam Jananam Punya Karmanam Te Dwanvam Ohanirmukva Vajante Mam Drida Vrataha. That those who have acted piously in previous lives and in this, whose sinful actions are eradicated, free from the duality of delusion, and gave themselves my service with determination. So we can see that those who are foolish and deceitful and sinful and antagonistic, they don't very easily get any kind of mercy. On the other hand, Prabhupada said that your position in devotional service is the result of Kripa Shakti, or mercy coming from the devotee. So there are some material, just like if someone is trained, the whole aim of the Vedic culture is to gradually train someone so that when they come in contact with a devotee, they're receptive to receive bhakti. That's the idea. The training is in itself is not bhakti, but the Vedic cultural training is so that when you come in contact with a devotee, then you appreciate the value of the devotee's association. Modern Western training means to appreciate, it's not to make one receptive to a devotee, because it's actually it's the exact opposite. Their training is that if you have money, if you have material knowledge, if you have material education, material birth, if you have material beauty, then you're qualified. As Prabhupada said, if a person, he may be the most sinful person, he might be a crook, a mafia, you know, a mafiosa, but if he may have his occupation may be, you know, liquidating people. But if he's dressed in a nice suit and he has his pockets full of notes and he has coins and they jingle, then people think he's a gentleman. And if someone is dressed in a dhoti, people wonder, you know, with a shaven head, he might be a very humble, clean, you know, person in the mode of transcendental goodness, but people will think that he's sinful because he doesn't have enough money to afford a nice dress, and you know, his hair fell out. So people's vision nowadays is exactly the opposite. They're being trained that if someone is deceitful, if they're actually from the Vedic point of view, foolish. If someone's sinful, then they're actually pious. Just like Hiranyakashipu, he decided that he'd turn around the laws of nature. That if anyone did any activity that was pious according to the Vedic direction, they go to hell. And the more sinful activities you perform, the more you performed activities against the Vedic direction, the more you become elevated in heaven. So that's more or less the modern understanding of things. Although there may be some contamination from the mode of goodness. Modern perspective. Therefore, people are actually being trained not to become receptive to the devotees. Prabhupada writes this in the first canto, fifth chapter, in the very famous verse, there's a systematic attempt on the part of people in society to stop the glorification of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, when people come in contact with us, we can understand there's two things. Number one is that there is some desire on the parts of people, because there is some cultivation of God consciousness still going on in society, whether it's coming from other religious groups or from our own religious group. There is a nurturing of God consciousness in the hearts of people. Therefore, Prabhupada said that people are hankering for these books. They actually want them. And therefore, Krishna, who's the super soul, he knows that this person has some desire, and therefore he sends the person to the devotee. At least there has to be a class of people like that that actually want the books. And then, from the other point of view, the desire of the devotee, if his desire is strong enough, then even though the person's desire may not be very strong, because of his intense desire, it may also cultivate immediately or nurture the desire of that person to get the book. No one is completely, it's very rare, anyone in our society is in a real, honest to goodness, 100% demon. I mean, you'd have to go to school and be trained up specifically to become a demon. Of course, nowadays they're trying to do that. Maybe there are some people who have been trained like that for many lifetimes, and they become pure, unalloyed demons. They're unmotivated, uninterrupted demons. But most people are just, you know, either they're fools or, you know, like that. Fools, mudhas, discreet. They fit into mostly the mudha category, and some of them are discreet. Naradamas, a few Maya Pritigyanas, and a few Asuramashrita, who are taking shelter of the demoniac mentality. So if the devotee's desire is strong enough, and by that desire, by that transcendental Shakti that Krishna manifested will manifest because of the desire of the devotee. Therefore, people become influenced by it and they'll take a book, although their desire may not be so strong. Is that clear?
Yeah. Regarding these people who may be receptive, now, is that receptiveness, are they receptive to bhakti, or the bhakti of the devotee, or are they receptive to perhaps some outward material piety that the devotee has, which appeals to them because they're in the mode of goodness? Whereas a sinful person sees the devotee as being, he doesn't, he's maybe not like averse to the bhakti, but he thinks, oh, this is some sort of sissy, or someone who's going to interfere with my sense gratification and preach to me. So I'm just wondering if the attraction that this innocent type of person or receptive type of person may feel towards a devotee, is it that, say, they were trained up in some religious practice in their childhood, like Christianity, which is far from pure bhakti, but maybe that, could that have given them something like a little bhakti?
Yeah, of course it does. Otherwise it's just animal life.
So then their attraction to the devotee could be on the level of attraction to bhakti, even though they're very mixed or confused.
Why people, generally speaking, we examine the devotee, his from two points of view. One is that there's a certain amount of material expertise that's required for book distribution. Without that material expertise, even though one may have bhakti, unless that bhakti is very strong, you won't be able to distribute any books. For instance, there are salesmen who are selling thousands of encyclopedias who have very little transcendental bhakti. Although, we'll find out as we go on that without bhakti, nothing goes on. You know, the very nature of bhakti, for instance, is manifested in the material world as enthusiasm, as confidence, and patience. So unless one cultivates enthusiasm, confidence, and patience within any kind of sphere of activity, there's no possibility of being successful. But the pure, unalloyed confidence, the real confidence, the real enthusiasm, the real patience come from bhakti. Now a devotee, he may have, by his previous pious activities, cultivated a certain amount of expertise, or even in this lifetime. And therefore he may be a better salesman than someone else and distribute more books. So that's necessarily the manifestation of his bhakti shakti. It's also the manifestation of his material expertise. But the long-term distribution of literature, transcendental literature, will be shown, that will reveal if he's able to do it over a long period of time, or at least encourage or support or work for it. That shows his bhakti, that bhakti is able to support that activity over a long period of time.
So these receptive...
On the other hand, whether someone... Why does he take a book? Unless the person is taking it out of fear, which is unlikely. You know, fear in the sense that the devotee says, you know, well, you take the book or we blow you away. One time, just to mention a cartoon that Prabhupada liked a lot. I showed Prabhupada this cartoon. There was a devotee in the airport, and he had a big book bag, and there was someone approaching him, and he goes, "Hi," and he put out his hand like that. And then in the next caption, the person looks and goes, "You know, hi." And after that, the next caption is this big cloud of smoke. And it's bang, whack, and then you see a hand out there, book bag here. And then it's finally everything clears away. And the man's on the ground with a book stuck down his throat. And he's always walking away with a big smile, counting the water. So, probably laughed when he saw that. That usually is not our technique. It doesn't last, you know, you can't do that to most people, at least. Therefore, there has to be some other cause. Whether it's something material, in the sense of the devotee's enthusiasm, etc., that has to play some part. But if it was just that, the devotee would be out there doing it. There has to be a certain amount of bhakti which motivates the devotee. So the person, you know, who's going to be encouraged to take this book, whatever it is, also by that. So to differentiate the two, between the devotee's expertise in performing the activity and his desire, you know, that would have, you'd have to be the super soul to be able to discriminate how much of it is bhakti and how much of it is material expertise. But if we have to see it through our own vision, that will have to be seen ultimately how consistently the devotee is performing the activities. If one day he's out there, he's a Maharathi, distributing hundreds of books, and the next day he's, you know, back at home watching Captain Kangaroo on television. We understand that bhakti, once it manifests itself, is usually more consistent than that.
So then the sinful person is not attracted to the devotee. Basically, this is what Buddha was saying. But another person who's more pious may be receptive. I'm just wondering whether the receptivity or lack of can be due to strictly the material piety or impiety.
Partly that, partly the desire of the devotee. Because after all, we are spiritual souls, and if the devotee actually has some feeling towards someone, actually wants to help the person, and the person automatically picks up on that. Just like, to give the example of Murari the Hunter, he was half killing animals because his father taught that. I don't know if he went to church or not, but I mean, that was his main education, is half killing animals and watching them flap to death. But then he came in contact with Narada Muni, although his first impulse was to curse, but due to Narada Muni's association, he could neither curse, but his consciousness changed. He became very respectful. So due to the transcendental potency of Narada Muni's transcendental desire to help the person, then he automatically, because he's a spiritual soul also, you might say colloquialism, he picked up on it and he accepted Narada Muni. So there is a transcendental education that can go on just by associating with the devotees. The devotees potent enough. So of course, if the person really trained up as a demon, he Morari is innocent. He was actually, you know, a conscious demon, then it becomes in contact with the devotee, he may get the opposite reaction. As we find that, then we get the opposite reaction. Just like Kamsa, he had a lot of association with Krishna, but he was, wasn't all positive upon his part. The more he associated with Krishna by thinking about him, the more he became a demon. I think that's it. So tomorrow we'll continue on with the first chapter, so if you can all read that. And if you have any questions, you can write them down on a piece of paper, please, and that way we can go over them. So thank you very much.